welcome everybody to an audio conference training series on safety and accountability audits for grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. So my name is Casey McGee, and I'm with Praxis, and I'll be your host for today's call. And Trish Irwin is with us to talk about thinking and acting like an auditor. So three real quick housekeeping details. I think all three of you probably will have heard these before, but I'm going to leave all the lines open, obviously, since there are just a few of us on the call. If you do have a lot of background noise, you can press star 6 on your phone to mute yourself and star 6 again to unmute. And when you're speaking, please say your name and the state you're calling from. And then, just as a reminder, we do record these calls, and we make them available for $8 a CD. The order form will go up on our website after the series is over. So I think we should go ahead and get started. Trish, welcome.
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you for all being here. So I just want to start by just checking in with who's on the call and what organization and state, and then any questions you have about today's topic. So maybe we could start with Pat from New Orleans.
I'm Pat from New Orleans. And we have a grant to encourage a RAS program. And as a part of that, I am the domestic violence coordinator at Civil Court, and I handle a lot of administrative duties as well as assisting pro se petitioners who come in for protective orders. We are interested in doing a safety audit because we have a family justice center that has just gone up, and it's we have a lot of challenges here in New Orleans. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Any questions about today's topic specifically, or just your
well, thinking and acting like an auditor, I don't even know what that means, so I'll just listen, you know. Hey.
Okay.
Well, that's
very
a bit of a publicity problem. We haven't made our publicity very clear, so that's good feedback.
Okay, how about Amy?
excuse me. Yeah, my name is Amy Watts, and I am actually one of the team members for the safety and accountability audit that we will be doing internally with our agency starting here in the next month or so. And I'm sitting in for Debbie because she's in court and she's a busy lady and taking notes, and I'm going to share that with the rest of my team when we meet next week.
Okay. Any specific questions about the topic today? Or?
You know, I just think that I'm, you know, just going to try to get a lot of the information to be able to share that, because we're going to be doing most of the observations, the team members will, while Debbie is more coordinating the program and the audit itself. So I think it'll be good information for us as team members, because we're going to be the ones who are actually observing the intakes and the, you know, doing the focus groups with the battered women. So
Amy's kind of said this, but just so Amy, from a broader perspective, there are very few organizations that advocacy organizations that have done audits of themselves. So their undertaking is very brave, and it's kind of unique. So
okay, cool. Thank you.
Great. Mm-hmm. All right, Julie, how about you?
Hi, I'm Julie. I also have Ron from the Sheriff's Office here with me. He's one of our audit team members.
Okay.
Here in Grand Forks, we are going to look at how our abuse and rape crisis program, the Wishing Well Child Visitation Program, and the Civil Court coordinate services to meet visitation needs for people getting protection orders. And I'm thinking, since we are also, for the first time, really looking into the visitation and program and the abuse and rape crisis program, which are our own programs, along with an outside one, I'm really interested in how we can look at ourselves with and not get people's shackles up, or you know, how can we say we're just looking at a procedure for them not to take it personally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ron, do you have any, do you want to introduce yourself? And
nope, I'm here learning.
Okay, all right, well, welcome. Okay, great, that's some good perspective that we've got on the phone. So what I want to do first is, Casey had asked me just to sort of review somewhat the audit trails, the 8 audit trails that are what audit team members are always looking at and thinking about. And I'm going to use an example from the audit that was recently completed in San Francisco. And so as a little bit of background, I was the audit coordinator for the audit we did in San Francisco. And I've also been on a couple other audits, one in Alaska, which actually did include a shelter program and a couple of police departments. And way back when, I did one with Casey, I think when we were both learning this about, it was like 10 years ago, Casey, or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and a few others along the way as well. So what I want to start with is talking about a little bit of the San Francisco audit and just using a specific concrete example to talk about some of the audit trails and how audit team members were sort of able to identify those and sort of acting like an auditor. So quickly in San Francisco, they undertook a audit of parts of the criminal justice system. They had been working on criminal justice reform efforts for about 5 years following a death review of a woman who had been murdered in town. Who'd become a typical case. She'd been in the system. The assailant had been in the system. And she was murdered. And so they reviewed everything and said, okay, we need to make these changes. And so the audit was used as an evaluation to say, okay, 5 years on, we've made all these changes, where are we now? And they looked at three specific points of intervention, 911 through the arrest decision, the felony investigation, through the what they call the rebooking decision, which is the prosecutor's decision whether to press to file charges or not in the case. And then when somebody's been put on probation and has violated probation, whether they're going to the motion to revoke process, which is whether they'll revoke probation or not. So those are the three snapshot moments we took. And we did what I think has come to be called the Blitz process, where we did it in 1 week, in September, and we had a team of about 15 audit team members. So that was sort of our process that we went through, and we broke up the team into three sub-teams, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in terms of the idea of when you talk about how do we get to look at ourselves and getting able to sort of not be defensive and stuff like that. So we found overall five sort of major gaps, and I just want to talk about one in particular that the team found around stalking, that in San Francisco there was sort of no systematic way of identifying stalking cases. They were obviously bubbling up through the system. There was a stalking prosecutor. He was getting a certain number of cases. But as we started reviewing, doing observations, interviews, and doing text analysis, and even right from the beginning of our training, we realized that there was all these ways through the audit trails in which stalking was not being identified on a systematic basis. So I'm going to go through the different audit trails and talk about how we found stalking was missing, and so what our findings were. So when we looked at administrative practices, we saw that in 911 they had a code system, so they had a priority A, priority B, priority C system. So priority A, police had to go out immediately. B, they had within 10 minutes to go out, and C was basic. If they could get there. And A was imminent danger, person still there, threat to life or property, right? And we looked at all the stalking cases, and they were all coded C because there was no imminent danger, because the person wasn't in the house, because it was just phone calls, because it was just, right? And so it wasn't being identified as stalking, so that in very few of the stalking cases would a subsequent arrest be made, because the person was usually gone by the time the police got there, if they ever actually got to the home. So that was an example of administrative practice.
Hey, Trish, this is Casey. Mm-hmm. I'll just interrupt quick, just in case folks don't know, there's a handout, you probably all know this, but there's some handouts that you downloaded or that were available on the web, just so you know, and that they all outline these audit trails that Nancy covered just really briefly during call one, so just kind of orienting folks to that.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
And so the other way within the police department, we saw all throughout every department, was how they coded what were stalking-like behaviors. So they didn't actually have a code for stalking. So that when we looked at police reports that had, a victim report 30 phone calls, or report being followed across town by an ex-husband or an ex-partner, they were coded as annoying phone calls, protection order violations, harassment, often with an appendage, sometimes by a sergeant who was reviewing it, it would say DV-related. So we could see this coming up, and this is so as auditors, as people sort of reading through these reports, we would either sit down as reading text together, and this is sort of thinking like an auditor. It wasn't to say, like, how come the cop didn't see this, but to say, wow, we're seeing like report after report in which this is annoying phone calls or harassment or terroristic threats, and this is the pattern we're seeing, is that there's stalking behaviors and they're being categorized like this, and this is an administrative practice. In terms of rules and regulations, because in San Francisco, if it was coded as like this annoying phone calls or PO violations, that would be a misdemeanor, and so there'd be no follow-up investigation in terms of going into the domestic violence unit. It would go straight, maybe not even to the domestic, not even to the DA's domestic violence unit. It might even just go to a general works, and not even get caught into the DV into any DV sort of path. So there was this way in which the way it was coded sort of from the very beginning would put it on a track that wouldn't get it into any kind of follow-up investigation. We looked at sort of education and what kind of things around education and training is that there was no mandatory training for police officers around stalking, that years before a law had been passed that said that our post board, the Peace Officer Standard and Training, had to create a stalking training, but that it wasn't mandated. So it was really interesting. So I was like, great, we've got this training, but it's actually no one has to have it, right? So we could see through this and that all the other workers in the system as well, 911 wasn't required to have any stalking training, probation wasn't required to have any stalking training, and nor prosecutors. The only one who had really had sort of, you know, in-depth stalking training was the one stalking prosecutor. So this is kind of, we were identifying as we sort of went through the system, like as we identified stalking as an issue, we sort of started looking a little more deeply to sort of see what was going on. In terms of linkages, we saw that that if it did get, it's a misdemeanor, if a case that had stalking-related behavior got to the DA's DV unit, because it was a misdemeanor, there was no follow-up investigation. This was a process particular to San Francisco, but it went right to what they call the morning review or morning arraignment with no background check. So you could have potentially, you know, 3, 4, 5 misdemeanors of the same victim, that no one person was sort of catching all of them because they were going to the misdemeanor DA and he or she didn't have enough time, and plus they rotated the morning DA 5 days a week so that it wasn't the same person in there who could say, oh, this is Kathy Smith again, oh, this is Kathy Smith again, or this is James, you know, Jones again, so that there was this way in which the linkages were happening that were sort of broken, that stalking cases were just going in every different direction, not even being labeled as stalking. Around mission, purpose, and function, we found that, and this is for a lot of DV cases, that because the criminal justice system really is geared not towards pattern crimes, which is what stalking is in and of itself, that people weren't seeing it. So, for example, in one of my observations, I was on a ride along with a police officer, and there was a woman who. Actually, it was interesting because I was waiting in the police station. I saw this woman come in, and she wanted to file a police report on being having been assaulted by her ex-boyfriend and the father of her 10-month-old child the day before. And she wanted an emergency protective order, and the on-call judge denied the emergency protective order because the assault had happened 24 hours before, and she hadn't reported it right away. And she had said she had had to work and she couldn't get in right away. And so she was in with an advocate. She was a Spanish-speaking woman. And she was telling the police officer who told the judge this as well, that he's gonna show up at my work tonight. He shows up every day. He's been showing up every day, and I'm really scared of him. He's threatened to kill me. But the EPO was denied anyways. So that I'm out on my ride-along, and we get called. Within 5 minutes, we get called to a domestic violence incident, and it's this woman. And this guy has shown up at her office, and he had a knife on him. He had a pocket knife on him, and she tells the same story. He's been showing up every day for 10 months, either at home or at work. They have a 10-month-old child in common, and there was no questions asked about custody or anything like that, but no, and so I asked the officer afterwards, and I said, do you think this is a stalking case? And he goes, he basically said no, and then he said, well, that's something for the investigators to figure out. So that the patrol officer, in terms of, like, what his purpose or his function was, wasn't thinking about, like, well, that's my job to figure out. He's thinking, well, the next person in line will get that, right, and they'll figure it out. So that there was this, not so much a passing of the buck, but just that no one person in the system saw it as their particular job to sort of investigate stalking, to identify stalking. So the cases were getting missed. Around concepts and theories, we had just the lack of training really made it that people didn't understand what was stalking. So that in several 911 calls, we hear a victim calling up, going, "I have a restraining order. This guy's, you know, he's here. He's outside my door. I don't know what to do." And the 911 operator would respond back, "He's just outside your door, right? Well, call us back if he gets to the door, or call us back if he comes through the door." And so this kind of not clear, because for the 911 operator, it wasn't sort of uncaring, but it was that they needed to know how to prioritize it. If he was just outside the door or just around the corner, for them it was priority C, and they couldn't bump it up until he was actually at the door. This was an imminent threat. And the idea that this sort of into the system, that stalking was more about bad breakups or stranger situations rather than that it was mostly about domestic violence or, you know, or drawn from those kind of cases. So finally, like around resources, is that there was a lack of technology in the system that allowed people to sort of talk to each other around these cases and sort of really follow up. So I'll talk more about this a little bit later, that I started identifying the ways in which it's sort of shocking when you think of the San Francisco, around the Silicon Valley and stuff like that, but police officers within the San Francisco Police Department don't have their own individual email. Oh, if I'm a prosecutor and I need to follow up with Officer Smith, who works the night shift or the midnight to 2 a.m. shift, I have to call that individual station and leave a message, which is posted to a bulletin board. And then that officer has to call me back, supposedly on their personal time. So there was a lack of resources. And these are only just some of the ways in which we saw stalking missing and saw stalking getting missed in other ways as well. So there was a lack of resources that contributed to this gap getting wider and wider throughout the system. And then the accountability in terms of to the victim, that the victims are the ones having being told constantly to sort of like follow up on the case, particularly stalking victims. They're told every time, we'll file another police report, follow up on this. Even when they did that, because we saw the way that the cases got coded, they never really got elevated to this level of being considered, you know, a serious stalking case. Was just restraining order violation, and a lack of accountability for the stalkers or the alleged perpetrators. In that, even if they were prosecuted, there was no particular stalking rehabilitation program. So if they even got into something, they might get put into like a batterer's intervention program, which we know from different research and different things is that they'd actually do really well in, because they learn either more behaviors or they're really able to sort of manipulate that system, or they teach other batterers within that program sort of how to be better stalkers in some ways, right? So in the murder case that we had 5-6 years ago in San Francisco, the alleged assailant was stalking his ex-girlfriend and was in a batterer's intervention program and was doing really, really well in it. In fact, had graduated with, like, you know, kudos and stuff like that. And we saw that within probation reports that we looked at as well, cases in which there was stalking behavior and someone had graduated really with high praise from their batterer's intervention program and continued to stalk their ex-girlfriend or their ex-wife or whatever it was. And just this way of the accountability from each intervener to the other, the way that it was like, one said, well, that's not my call, I don't have to do it, so that's not my, you know, that's the police have to make that call, or the inspector has to make that call, or the DA has to make that call. And so there was this, you know, that's not my job kind of thing. So the accountability in the system of each intervener to each other. So in terms of the trails, we all were sort of, we put the focus in those. Our recommendations then, go back to those trails as well. And so, you know, we had talked about introducing a stalking code for 911, which they're moving forward apparently on doing, that they introduce a stalking code for police, for the police department. And they have actually already gone out apparently in San Francisco and created and done training with all the police officers, patrol officers, to identify stalking. And so the patrol officers are like, oh, so if we think it's, you know, there's 40 restraining order violations or 40 phone calls, we should call that stalking or stalking related. And they said, yeah. And so now the caseload's increasing. And just as sort of an anecdote, I was doing a part of a cross-training institute for all the criminal justice practitioners that followed from the audit. We put together a curriculum based on the audit findings. And the stalking DA was supposed to come to, he was scheduled for like one, and he missed that one. He was scheduled for another one, and he missed that one. And I asked one of the other DAs, I said, well, where is he? You know, where's the stalking DA? Is he going to be able to come? And they said, no, you know, he's really busy lately. You know, he always used to have like one pile of files on his desk. Now he's got like two or three. He's like, they're going to need another stalking DA pretty soon. And this was like 6 months after about 3 months after we'd finished the audit, and training had already started. 911 operators had been trained on stalking a little bit. They said, we're going to start using a stalking protocol. So you could see just through a few changes in administrative practices that the police were starting to use stalking in their police reports, that the DA was now, and the links were going differently. So now the DA was going to the domestic violence unit for a follow-up investigation, then going into the stalking DA. So he was actually seeing an increased caseload just like in a 3 to 4 month time. So it was really interesting the way that it happened so quickly, just through a few changes like in administrative practices, through training, through better linkages through some of those folks. So that's sort of a review of the trails and the audit trails. Any questions or comments from anyone?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Casey, do you have anything? I mean, you were there at that very first training we did, and we even just saw stalking right at the beginning. Do you have anything to say on that? Or
no. I love that example, though. It's really, really fun to hear from you all how you ended up finding problems in this. And I think so far we haven't done this on this series of calls yet, heard some very, very specific examples about how it is that people can avoid taking things personally, because you all are very, very good at being able to keep your eyes on, like, you know, you kept coming back to, it's not the fact that people don't care. It's the fact, it's all these other reasons, how it is that stalking just kind of gets missed through parts of the system. So, no.
And we found, I mean, and I'll move on a minute, but we found just even like with our 911 operators that, I mean, I listened to 591 calls initially, and I was as the audit coordinator, but also as an audit, thinking like an audit team member, and my initial reaction was, oof, you know, they're a little short sometimes with folks, right? And I was thinking, wow, that's, you know, you kind of immediately go to like, what's going on, you know, what's going on here and stuff. And we found out during the course of the audit is that even just one of their problems is that they're not only are they phenomenally understaffed within the 911, within the call takers, dispatchers and call takers, but they also had this particularly uniquely, I think, somewhat San Francisco problem, is that there was parking issues, and there wasn't enough parking spaces for all the 911 operators, so they had to park metered spots and in like two-hour parking spots. So even if they were on phone calls, this is like during the day, they'd be watching their watches to see when they had to go either put change in their meters or go out and move their cars because it was in a two-hour zone. So they were, like, really stressed about things like that, as well as the phone calls they were taking, right? So in some way, sometimes when they were really short, you can imagine that they were thinking, oh, my God, there goes my meter. And they were getting ticketed really regularly by the Department of Parking and Transportation. So even though they might have, like, they sounded a bit short on the phone, there was some reasons there that we uncovered as the audit team of why that was happening. So, but that was another whole other issue. And we tried to get them parking passes, but we weren't able to do it. So, what are some challenges that folks think to putting together an audit team, or what are some of the things that have either already come up for folks, or what do you think some challenges might be in putting together an audit team?
This is Amy from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I know on our end, Debbie, our audit coordinator, she is the only person who's funded under GTEP to actually do the audit. So myself and the other team members were actually funded to do other things. I'm a teen anger management counselor. And so we just tried to find people who had the availability and the time to kind of work on this in addition to doing what we're actually funded here to do.
Okay.
It's been a challenge because we've changed, you know, team members a few times. People have come in and realized they didn't have enough, you know, weren't going to be able to put the time in and had to go out. We had to find some other people. So I think that's been a little bit of a challenge as far as for Debbie trying to get a team together.
Mm-hmm. How about other folks?
When you were in San Francisco, this is Pat from New Orleans, they welcomed you to come. They wanted you to come and do this, right?
The city, it was the Department of Status of Women that had run this evaluate, what was called the Justice and Courage Project, and they wanted to do an evaluation of Justice and Courage. So, yes, they wanted to do an audit.
So when you went to the DA and the police and the dispatch, and all those people were very cooperative because they wanted you to come.
I can talk about that in a minute, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that they all wanted us to come. I would say that the Department of the Status of Women and the Justice and Courage panel, which was more community-based members and activists, they wanted to do it. So we did have to sell all of the agencies on doing this.
I'd really like to know how you did that.
Okay. I can talk about that. How about... Julie, any thoughts about any challenges to putting together an audit team or?
Well, a lot of us kind of got assigned asked for in-house, and then we just looked for some people who were already active in our CCR.
Okay.
Who we thought would have some good insight and tried to get a range of some experiences. So.
Okay. I mean, I think, so I'll go into that. We did talk, I mean, we, in San Francisco, as in any city, there were barriers or challenges to it. There's a history between the agencies. Traditionally, the DA and the police department have not been very copacetic with each other, and they had sort of changed that, but then there was a big case a couple of years ago when the DA made a decision which the police department didn't like. So we had some historical things around that. Just the political issues of having elected officials versus appointed officials. So we were going in asking 911, police, DA, and probation, and three or four of them are appointed by the mayor. The DA is obviously elected, so we had to deal with those kind of issues and in addressing kind of confidentiality. So I mean, I think the way we approached it was this Justice and Courage panel, which in some ways operated like a coordinating council. It was it's been the most active in doing DV coordinating stuff, particularly around the criminal justice system in San Francisco. So six months before we wanted to do the audit, we kind of backtracked. We said, okay, well, if we want to do the audit here, we're gonna back this up and say we wanted to meet with all the officials first, and we got money. So actually, I want to back up a little bit more. So we got the mayor. We actually got money from the mayor's office to commit to helping to fund the audit. And it wasn't very much. It was like $40,000. I don't know how much that would translate into the different communities that you're all in, but it wasn't a lot of money. It was paid a little bit of salary for coordinator. And one thing it did do, Amy, was what we've committed to doing right from the very beginning was to compensate community-based organizations for their time. So we put into that our budget was six days for six community-based organizations at like $250 a day or whatever was, you know, I think I talked to a few of them and said, what would make up for like a day's worth of work kind of for your organization kind of thing. And so we budgeted that in if we were able to get some money for it. So that's a planning, you know, it's kind of a planning thing if you can kind of get that. I mean, it certainly made it much easier for those agencies, the community-based agencies that we got, to actually have that reimbursement to their folks to be able to participate fully in the audit. because we ended up taking like 10, at least 10 days of their time, full, like almost full time from them. So does that make sense, Amy, or is that something?
Yeah, that makes sense, because I think that, you know, we've had to change out some people due to, well, on paper, how does this, you know, how does this match with how we're paying them, kind of thing. So what did you say that resource was again? What did, I'm sorry, Doug.
We got funding from the mayor's office.
Okay.
Someone went, we had a commission, we have a commission on the status of women in San Francisco, and one of the commissioners went, she was the co-chair of the Justice and Courage panel, and also like a coordinating council, and she went to the mayor and said, you know, this is part of the overall city's commitment to domestic violence, and we think this is something you should fund. It's an evaluation. It's proactive. And this is how much, you know, and we kind of had a rough budget at that point, but we actually got money to reimburse those. I think it ended up being like 4 or 6 community-based members, but it really did enable us to get the people that we really wanted on the team.
Yeah.
To be there. It made a big difference.
Okay.
So, and then, Pat, in terms of getting the other agencies on board, did they want to do it? I mean, you know, there's always political pressure for groups to sort of to go in and do these kind of things. So we did have a level of cooperation from this Justice and Courage project. People have been used to being worked together and doing things together. But this was a little, as audits are, they're much more in depth. You're asking for people's time, a little more intense time. You're asking for files, for police reports, things like, you know, much more information and a sort of much more deeper kind of commitment.
Right.
So as I said, we backed it up. So in like the spring, we made appointments with all the heads of. So we had an appointment with the police chief, the DA, the head of 911, and the head of probation. And we had a group of us. So I was going to be the audit coordinator. We had someone from the Department of Status of Women, a community-based, someone from the DV community organization, I think, and then someone from that person's agency who'd been actively involved in DV work, like a captain for the police department or somebody else from like the DA's office who'd been working on like a coordinating council or something like that, and we'd meet with them and give them a background on general work in the city, and then I'd do a spiel on the audit and the audit process, and give them what one of our other people on the team came to call sort of the elevator speech. Is like, how do you sell the audit in 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
right, to a sort of somebody, a bigwig. And so it was all about sort of reducing their defensiveness to this, right? And one of the key points was talking about it being a proactive way of sort of identifying gaps in the system, rather than, you know, when something goes wrong in a system, people often go in and do death reviews and say what's, you know, who's at fault, that kind of stuff. We said to them, this is a proactive way of seeing where we're at, how we can make improvements in the system. And then I talked about the ways in which how the audit worked is that it went deeper into the system. And my one of my examples was to think about the different ways each agency is organized to think about domestic violence and to respond to a domestic violence incident. This is part of my sort of quick overview of an audit. Is that if you had a 911 call of a domestic violence incident, and it was a woman called in and said, I've just been beaten up, and there's a child in the home, the 911 operator has the immediate safety of the caller in mind, and officer, and what police officers need to get there, and police officer safety in mind, and that's how the 911 operators and 911 operators are thinking about it. And this is a way of getting to sort of understand what the audit process is about, and what kind of questions we were going to be asking. So how people are organized to think about domestic violence cases.
Mm-hmm.
That the police officer going into the scene is thinking about the immediate safety of anyone at the scene, thinking about whether they have probable cause to make an apprehension, you know, and what are the next steps in their own investigation. That if a CPS worker came out, their orientation to the scene as, are the children safe? Can this mother continue to mother after everyone leaves, or do the children need to be removed? And or if the apartment manager, say it was a rental, is thinking, you know, who's going to repair the damage? Who's going to pay for this? Is this assailant going to return? Is he or she on the lease? You know, and can this, if that person doesn't return, can this can this victim continue to pay the rent kind of thing. So people are oriented differently to the way the audit thinks and acts is the way that people are oriented differently to domestic violence cases. And so that's how we think and act like an auditor. We ask those questions from those different perspectives. And we also talked about how if you did this audit with anybody, like some of you are doing, like within a family crisis center or a civil court, anywhere, you'd find the same kind of gaps. And so that it really is this proactive methodology, right? So that it wasn't about targeting any one department. We also made an agreement not to make anything, this is part of the confidentiality thing, that we wouldn't release the findings publicly. So that, and this is a little bit of a shell game in some ways, because the Freedom of Information Act, probably anybody could get this final report of the findings and recommendations that we did, but that's for each department to sort of handle on their own. But what we said was we would release a report that was to the public that was executive summary with all the recommendations, but that the nitty-gritty stuff that says things like, you know, we heard, you know, police officers describing, you know, different ethnic groups this way, that's not going to be released publicly. That's going to go to the police, you know, it's going to go to just the department heads, and they're going to see that stuff on their own, and that's not going to be something that is going to be talked about or released to the press or anything like that. And that was a big point, I think, for the department heads, because there'd been a lot of sort of splashy newspaper stories about the police department and about the, you know, different problems within the agencies. And we also knew exactly what we were going to ask for each one of them before we went in. So we went in asking for ideally what we'd have is two people from each department. Ideally what we'd have is a supervisor type of person and then a regular frontline worker. So, you know, an investigator or a patrol officer. And we, you know, that's the kind of thing that we'd really like to get. For the most part, what we found happened is that, you know, once we kind of did one and it went well, we went to the police chief first, and we kind of knew that they would probably buy in with us. And so as we went to the next one, we said, you know, the police department's on board, and so then they'd kind of be, and then the next one would be on board, so 911 would be on board, then we'd go to probation, and we'd say, well, you know, police and, you know, 911 are on board, so we're really hoping you'd be on board. And the hardest was the DA. It's an elected official, and they're always the most sticky. I mean, I think Casey can attest to that, that a lot of these calls are about DA's offices being, you know, reluctant, reticent, or, you know, not wanting to get involved. And we got the lease from the DA's office, I think, at the end of the day. We didn't know until a week before our training who our representatives on the audit team were, because what they did was the DA asked the head of her DV unit to call I think they tried to identify this in case, and I went back and forth a few times trying to figure it out, but all places in the United States that had done audits included prosecutor's office, offices, and wanted him to call every one of them and to find out what their experience was. So he did that to the extent that he could get the information, right, Casey?
Yeah,
and
get out trying to pull together.
Yeah, it was difficult to pull together, but he came back with like 90% favorable reviews. It was one, I think, he found where an audit team member had sort of broken confidentiality and like written a letter to the editor of the newspapers and let that in the middle of the audit, you know, which it would recommend against generally, right? So by going, I think, 6 months before we were even going to begin the audit and really getting this buy-in from the agencies, we also got a letter from the mayor to the department heads, and three of them are appointed by him, so that helped. And then one was elected saying, you know, we really want you to participate in this audit. So that really helped quite a lot. So we had all that kind of, we really did the political, you know, kind of hand-holding, getting in there, really working all the different players individually and giving them all, like, as many questions as they wanted to ask of us one-on-one rather than bringing together as a group. And I think that was really beneficial in getting that buy-in that we needed. Does that make sense, or
yes.
Any questions?
Yes, it does.
Okay. With the community groups, we have a domestic violence consortium. We have San Francisco's got 15 DV, different DV type agencies. And So we put out a call for volunteers on that one. And we had to balance both sort of the professionalism and cultural representation. So at one point we ended up with like 4 or 6 of them as white attorneys, and that was sort of problematic. So we had to do some sort of strategizing and move people around to kind of to get down to like one or two attorneys, and then get the other people on that we wanted when we wanted on the audit team. So I think in building the audit team and sort of being able to get people to sort of think being the right folks on the audit team, we were able to sort of do that prep work that was really the critical thing, and getting sort of good critical thinkers on the team as much to the extent that we could. We had little less control over the agency personnel who were going to come onto the audit team, but we were hoping that they'd be sort of open-minded and, you know, that they could sort of think critically about what was going on and stuff like that and about seeing the system.
Trish, this is Casey. How long would you say that whole laying the groundwork phase took for you all? Not that it always takes, but I remember it took kind of a while.
It took 2 or 3 months.
Huh. Yeah.
So in 2 months, 2 months of meetings times, I think, over 2 months it took us to meet with everybody that we needed to.
I remember before then that the Justice and Courage Committee kind of deliberating over whether or not the audit was a good idea for kind of a while. So there was that whole phase of it too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall it was about over. I mean, there was a lot of before that that people were thinking of whether they wanted to use this methodology or not, and trying to in talking about the sort of ways in which it is different. It's a different way of sort of thinking about how to evaluate the system, and people were interested in that. That it seemed to reduce the defensiveness, and I think that's that piece about there had even been one of the death reviews. There had been 2 sort of high profile murders in San Francisco, one more than 10 years ago now, one or 15 years ago, and then the one 5 years ago. And I believe in one of them, one of the reports that I saw, they actually sort of named people's names who were involved with the cases. And there's obviously a desire, I think, in a lot of when things go wrong, right, that we figure out who messed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you think about Hurricane Katrina, or you think about even NASA, you know, disasters and stuff like that. There are always people are going, okay, who do we look at? Who can we, you know, say is at fault here? And the audit is really sort of fundamentally different in that it's really looking at this idea of institutions and not individuals. It's saying how can we look at how the institutions are organized rather than looking at particular individuals within the system? And I think with our community members, that was a challenge in terms of, like, thinking like an auditor. Like, I had to overcome a lot of historical, not animosity is probably too strong of a word, but suspicion of folks in the criminal justice system about their individual motives. Like, you know, I'd say, you know, it's not the individual police officer, or not the individual judge, or the individual, you know, prosecutor. And it was this sort of real resistance to that initially, and getting them to really think like an auditor and say, okay, it's really about how these 8 trails really organize these individual workers. The police officer doesn't show up to work one day and decide where he or she is going to patrol in the city. They're told where they're going to patrol, what calls they're going to respond to, how they're going to respond, what questions they're going to ask, you know, when they can make an arrest, if they've got probable cause, you know, this kind of stuff, that they're very highly organized, and everybody in this system is highly organized. So, you know, you've got to be aware of that and really constantly sort of going back to that that idea with folks on the audit team. We even had that mantra of institutions, not individuals, put up on blow it up on a poster, and we put it up in the room whenever we met, so that we could kind of always point to it and be like, if someone was kind of going down that path of saying, well, you know, officer so and so said X, or you know, probation officer blah, we'd be like, it's well, how, you know, institutionally, how did that mm-hmm. come about, kind of thing, and really try to pull people back to that thinking more globally. Any questions, anything, any comments?
This is Amy in Texas.
Sure.
You mentioned, you know, looking at the institution, not the individual. Have you ever come across a situation where maybe, like, the institution and practices put in place were there and were, you know, pretty right on, but it was the individual that was off base and how to respond in that situation.
I mean, I think you always have to sort of think, how is this coming about? I mean, or what's happening with that situation? I mean, certainly in doing the audit in San Francisco, we heard, you know, individual officers or individuals throughout the system saying things that which could be perceived as racist or other things like that. But you have to really look at where is that coming from? Like, why are they? How is their understanding of that coming about? And is it based in their experience of their system, of their calls, or whatever? And that's, you kind of go back to that. I mean, I think with any system, maybe Casey can speak to this more broadly as well. I mean, generally in an audit, I mean, you're looking at the average worker on the average day. So you're going to always have some of those, you will probably potentially find a bad egg once in a while, you know, where someone who's really kind of off the deep end or off the thing, but your focus should be on the average worker on an average day. And so you don't, when you go in to interview or observe people, you don't necessarily want, you know, the A number one person to be, you know, to be watching who's going to do absolutely everything right or the one who's going to do everything wrong. You want the person who is kind of middle of the road, might be learning things for the, you know, might be 2 or 3 months into the job or been there for 10 years or whatever, but that they're kind of a, you know, just middle of the road.
Okay.
And there's going to be... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I cut you off.
Oh, go ahead, Stacey. Go ahead, Casey.
People do kind of ask at the front of an audit, like, what if we see somebody doing something hazardous? And I'm not sure if this is what you're getting at exactly, but that's very, very rarely seen, where you see somebody mm-hmm. doing something that, like, really seems to be putting somebody in danger. And, of course, that isn't something that auditors, you know... Of course, we would all respond as a human being would respond and maybe try to do something about that. But for the most part, at the beginning of an audit, you're very clear with the administrators that the audit won't be attending to personnel issues. People who are poor employees really is a private personnel issue of an organization, and it's not so much what an audit is looking for, which, like Trish said, is trying to figure out what's the standard practice. So if the institution has generally good set up to do things right and you've got one person off doing something kind of weird, the audit is not... just going to really kind of pass past that, like Trish said, and really just look at, we want your solid employees, people who can tell us about how your system is set up, because we're not here to find the bad egg, which you'll find really in any organization. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
And I think one of the key things that I've learned over the years of doing these and stuff is the questions of, like, how to ask the questions when you're auditing, when you're observing, you're interviewing, is... One of the key questions, like, sort of not to ask is sort of why something's happening. Because why, almost, if you think about it, if you're asked, like, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that way? You know, it's like you almost immediately kind of feel like you're on the defensive. Like, ooh, I got to explain myself now, right? And it feels almost sort of personal. And, like, there's some, you've got to come up with a good reason of why you're doing it, right? It's like, you know, when your mother asked you when you're 5 years old why you took the cookie out of the cookie jar, right? It's like, oh, gosh, I got to come up with that answer now, right? And so the better question is, how does this happen? And getting somebody to explain in real detail how something comes about, like how a practice has come about over time, right? That, you know, when we asked about the coding of the police reports, like how come you don't have a stalking code? And they're like, so we started hearing from officers when we were on these ride-alongs that they had 3 different police report programs on their computers, in their cars, and at the police stations, stuff like that. The codes have been changed so many times. Most of them hadn't been trained in the late, you know, so there's all these reasons, right? So if we'd said, why don't you call it stalking, there would have been more, they would have closed down more. We said, how is it that you don't have a stalking protocol? It's like, they change it, they don't ask us. Some outside firm comes in. They give us the new codes. They don't train us. So there was all these sort of reasons and stuff like that. We asked about the idea that, you know, how is it that prosecutors have so little direct contact with patrol officers? And we got this answer that, you know, there's no email contact. There's very little phone contact. So you get a much more rich, deep answer when you ask the question of how, as opposed to why. That the why can shut people down very, very quickly. And when you ask how, people because people there are the experts at their jobs, and that's really, I think, what you want to emphasize, too, is sort of thinking like an auditor. It's almost, you want to come in and say, I'm walking in, like, I want to learn, like, as if I have to do this job tomorrow. And that's sort of, like, one of the keys is thinking like an auditor, is think, you need to learn everything about this person's job so that if tomorrow you were put in his or her position, you could do it. So it's, you know, what technology do you have? What resources do you have? What kind of training have you had? You know, how does this work? How does that happen? That kind of thing. And so it's really getting detailed and question-oriented about sort of how they do their work and how they're oriented to their work. And as you go through all that stuff, and later ones, you sort of start seeing these themes come up about these trails that help identify the gaps within the system as they're created in these different systems. Any questions or comments about that? Anybody? Okay. I think, we've got a few more minutes left. I guess overall I would say that in the key things in my experience, and everyone has to, you know, go from their own, you know, in their own communities and stuff particularly, is that to think like an auditor is particularly getting the individual and the audit team to overcome their individual agendas. And so that's really key when you go forward with an audit, is that people aren't going in there with, like, we're going to expose X or something like that. That it really is a positive, forward-looking piece, that particularly when an agency, whether it be a nonprofit or a criminal justice agency or a civil court or something like that, the audit process really opens up an agency in a way that's very, very different, I think, from even having an outside evaluator or anything like that. They'll come in. It's like people from the community, you know, other agencies looking at your text, looking at things like that. So that being very respectful of who's at the table, and that people are going to respect that people, that there's other ones at the table. Like, we had to talk about the police department, patrol response with a patrol officer, a sergeant there at the table, and how to do that in a way that wasn't going to, you know, make him feel alienated, but actually had him part of the process and be able to help us inform us of what was going on and how things were going. And that really can happen by really always sort of reframing about how institutions change and how it's at institutional processes, and really looking at that rather than looking at individuals to blame or saying, well, this cop did this or this 911 operator doesn't care because they cut that person off really quick. You know, it's really like, why? How come that is happening? It was interesting on our team. One of the things we also did was when we broke it up into three things. I had two 911 folks. Neither one of them were put on the 911 team, the group that looked at 911. And so that was sort of a strategic decision that I made to put people outside of their own area, both so that they could learn different areas of the system, as well as that they wouldn't then be auditing their own department, their own area kind of thing. And that might be a challenge depending on what you're auditing and who's on your audit team. But we had one 911 operator, she was a supervisor for 911. It was very interesting because she said once she realized she wasn't going to be on the 911 team, she just gave up all control at that point of trying to control the outcome of the audit, right? So it was quite funny. So she sort of really shifted. And this woman in particular these 911 folks came in probably the least experience in terms of DV, with even just this methodology and stuff like that. But this one woman, really, I saw her like a few months and weeks and later after this audit, and she's still thinking like an auditor. She's still listens to 911 calls with a very different ear than she did when she came into this whole process. And she's very motivated now to sort of think, trying to change her system. She's gone forward with creating scripts for her call takers around DV and around stalking and getting the training in there that they need to get and stuff like that. So it really, the audit can really change the people on the team as well, and how they see the way in which their own institutions change. So they might be looking at some other institution, but then they can come back and start looking at their own institution differently as well. And I think that creating that team bond as well amongst your audit team, to the extent possible, really gets them to sort of think more audit-like, right? So having a place to meet that's outside of everyone else's office and stuff like that can really create that thinking like an auditor more,
mm-hmm.
and getting them to sort of have that more analysis of what's going on, and being able to step back from their day-to-day jobs and really think of how institutions work and how institutions are organizing the daily lives of victims as well as the workers, and what those gaps are that are being created in the system. So any questions? Or
no, this has been very helpful.
Good. All right. Casey, is that pretty much time? Or that's what it looks like on my clock. So
yeah, we could go on just a little bit longer if we wanted to, but no, certainly, unless folks don't have more questions. Yeah, you covered it very well.
Very well.
I don't know. Okay. So thanks everybody for joining us today. And just as a reminder, if any of you want to talk in more detail about your plans, or if you have questions, or you want to brainstorm some strategies, that's what we're here for. So you can feel free to contact us individually, either by email or by phone.
Okay.
So as a reminder, please send us your evaluation form.
Okay.
Very helpful. And reminder to join us for the very last call in this series is on Tuesday. And Jane Sadowski is going to talk about how you actually do your data collection during an audit. So everybody have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Trish.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye, everybody.